If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Newton Media Group, a family of creative services, presents the Voice Over Work podcast, an eclectic collection of insights, knowledge, and trivia from some of the newest audiobooks on the market. This is Russell Newton. I'll be your host for the podcast, and thank you for listening. Hope things are going well for you today. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at A Secret History of Consciousness, written by Gary Lachman, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2003 by Lindisframe PR. Production copyright by Spoken Tome Media. You need to hear this. Part 5, The Presence of Origin. Chapter 25, The Ascent of Mount Ventoux. Sometime in the year 1336, an Italian poet, Francesco Petrarca, known to posterity as Petrarch, did something that no one in history had done before. He climbed a mountain to see the view. Obviously, people before Petrarch had climbed mountains, but it was always for some utilitarian reason. Hannibal crossed the Alps to attack Rome, and Moses climbed Mount Sinai to receive the word of the law from Jehovah. And thousands, maybe millions of unnamed people before and since must have pushed their way over inhospitable peaks for dozens of reasons. In search of food, to escape marauding bandits, to discover fresh grazing land. But no one before Petrarch had gone to the trouble of climbing an uninviting and dangerous summit simply for what we would call aesthetic reasons. At least, we have no record of anyone prior to Petrarch doing this. As we saw in the last section, as late as the 18th century, the mountains and other wild landscape that today's vacationers seek out for pleasure and relaxation were, if possible, rigorously avoided. And the idea of climbing anything more arduous than a hillock would have prompted a groan of complaint from Dr. Johnson and just about everyone else, until Wordsworth and Coleridge made the pastime popular. It is difficult for us to grasp, but something as obvious to us as the enjoyment we receive from taking in the view of some scenic vista was, in Petrarch's time, utterly unknown. To put oneself at risk in order to do so was considered madness, or worse. For some minds, it was even considered demonic. In a letter to the Augustinian... Chapter 26, Structures of Consciousness. The Ever-Present Origin is a massive work of some 600 pages, filled with charts, illustrations, a dense etymological appendix, and chapter notes often numbering more than 100. It is a work of immense learning, erudition, and wisdom, and assumes the reader has a familiarity with the history and culture of Western civilization, as well as some knowledge of the more esoteric strains of human creativity. Its scope covers religion, mythology, philosophy, literature, science, history, jurisprudence, psychology, and what today we would call the paranormal. Along with presenting a daunting synthesis of all human cultural activity for the last few millennia, it is an attempt to, in Uspensky's terse phrase, think in other categories, a confident leap into ontological uncertainty, with little more than poetic insight and intuition, and the unwieldy tool of language as guides. Gebser is not alone in recognizing that one of the chief tasks of philosophical thought in the 20th and now 21st centuries is to augment our language. Informed as it is with the metaphysical bias of our currently deteriorating mental rational structure, in order to open it to the new meanings presented by the emerging aperspectival consciousness. Hence, his already rich work is filled with new coinages, whose meanings are not always apparent, or, when they seem to be readily comprehensible, are found to be more difficult than anticipated. Further, Gebser, like Martin Heidegger, uses familiar words in an unfamiliar way and engages in lengthy and, at times, abstruse etymological analyses. Readers may at first be mystified by recurring terms like... Chapter 27, The Mental Rational Structure. With each of the structures emerging, or, as Gebser would say, mutating out of origin, there is an increasing separation from the source, a progression away from the atemporal, ever-present. Yet, up to the mythic period, there's still a strong connection between origin and the unfolding structures. In Owen Barfield's term, they still participate, and it is perhaps in the mythic structure that a kind of optimum relation emerges. The unity with origin is still strong, yet consciousness has pulled away enough to be aware of that unity. After this comes a radical break. All three previous structures are very different from our own consciousness. To us, total immersion in any of them would, in all probability, seem like an altered state. But now we're touching on the roots of our own form of mind. The next consciousness structure to emerge is what Gebser calls the mental rational. As I mentioned earlier, its appearance was as profoundly shattering as a natural catastrophe. The ambiguity and uncertainty characteristic of what we call the postmodern condition can give us some idea of how people must have felt in the first stages of the mental rational structure. But I believe the experience for them was much more disruptive. And if we're to go by Julian James's account, it was. It really must have been as if a world had been destroyed, for with the rise of the mental rational structure, the link between inner and outer space was, if not entirely severed, at least made extremely tenuous. We can liken it to when a child first realizes it is a separate being, an independent self, no longer completely under the protection of its parent. Chapter 28, The Integral Structure. Gebser's descriptions of the new consciousness structure provide some of the most unwieldy passages in The Ever-Present Origin. Here, his neologizing reaches an evocative power and a density that'll be difficult for all but the most dedicated readers. This is to be expected. What is involved is nothing less than our transformation, our mutation, into another form of reality. The present deconstruction of the mental rational structure is in preparation for this new dispensation. There's no guarantee that the new structure will emerge before the total collapse of the old. That's up to us. The challenge is whether we will participate in the new mutation consciously or simply be carried away by its effects. As its name implies, the integral consciousness structure is characterized by integration. In this case, the integration of the previous four structures. This recapitulation of older, more primitive forms of consciousness in a new mode is something we've already come across several times in this discussion. For Gebser, it means a return to origin after our long progression away from it in the various consciousness structures that have unfolded through time. Such a return means several things for Gebser. One is what he calls the concretizing of the spiritual. As the word concrete suggests, this is a condition in which the spiritual becomes actually present and perceivable, no longer merely intuited, conceptualized, or felt. With the irrational integral structure, the actual originary presence, the primal uncreated light, is made apparent. The spiritual will be seen, not as an object among other objects, but as the inner radiance that has hitherto... Last words. Playing for time. It would be easy to go on with this account of our life in the fast lane. Whole books, like Gleick's, have been devoted to it. I've gone on at length about the negative side of time's eruption merely to show that, at least on this account, Gebser seems to have been prescient. If this were all there was to it, however, there would be little to look forward to, except an increasingly frenetic world. More than likely, that will be the case. But other aspects of the time question seem also to have appeared. Not everyone is happy with the pace of things. semi-comical gestures like the Slow Food Movement, whose emblem is the snail, and more serious organizations like the Long Now Foundation and the Society for the Deceleration of Time, suggest that at least some of the population is determined to drag its feet. And in the last few decades, questions about time have gained a significant foothold in the popular idea of the physical sciences. The success of Stephen Hawking's widely bought but little read A Brief History of Time, 1988, clearly shows that. It is an axiom of both classical Newtonian as well as quantum physics that time's arrow, the relentless progression into the future, is a negligible factor. Time, scientists say, could flow backward, forward, or in any direction, with no effect on our understanding of the laws of physics. This atemporality has received many shocks in recent years. Through the work of Ilya Prigogin on dissipative structures, and the research of the celebrated Santa Fe Institute on chaos theory and complexity, entropy, the felt movement of time, has become a subject for serious investigation, providing good arguments against this. This has been A Secret History of Consciousness, written by Gary Lachman, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2003 by Lindisframe PR. Production copyright by Spoken Tome Media. You need to hear this. More information regarding today's book and the author can be found at audible.com or amazon.com. Show notes and further information can be found at russelericnewton.com. With a collection of trivia, research, news stories, and knowledge from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work Podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.